Hello and welcome to the Left of Boom podcast. This is an audio edition only featuring our own Phil Wilson and Peter List of Labor Relations Radio talking about employer free speech. Hope you enjoy the episode.
This is a special episode of Labor Relations Radio and Phil Wilson from LRI's Left of Boom. Phil, how are you today?
I'm good, Peter. I'm looking forward to our, we're gonna jointly drop this episode on the Left of Boom show and Labor Relations Radio. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, it's one of those topics that I think is pretty important to everybody out there who is threatened by a union campaign, in that we're talking about Amazon's Andy Jassy and the comments that he made over the course of about a year, where the National Labor Relations Board just found what seems to be pretty innocuous statements to be violations of the act.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. But this opinion is sort of the natural, to me, it's the natural progression of kind of where the general counsel is hoping to push the law. She was not able to get the ALJ to go sort of all the way, as far as she wanted, but this administrative law judge went pretty far down the road of kind of restricting just about anything an employer can say about unions without it being considered a unlawful threat.
Right. And so for the listeners, there are three interviews that the CEO of Amazon gave back in, 2021, 22 timeframe. Mm-hmm. To NBC Squawk Box. There's a event on behalf of, I believe it was the New York Times, and another one, mm-hmm. wherein he pretty much said the same thing. And what I figured we could do is let the listeners listen to the audio, and then we can go off on that.
Sounds good.
Okay, so hold on 2 seconds.
How do you see the union movement that's taking place, frankly, around the country, but clearly aimed in certain places, and I'm thinking about New York, where I'm from, at Amazon?
Well, I mean, I'd say a few things. First of all, of course, it's employees' choice whether or not they want to join a union. We happen to think they're better off not doing so for a couple reasons, at least. A place like Amazon empowers employees. If they see something they can do better for customers or for themselves, they can go meet in a room, decide how to change it, and change it. That type of empowerment doesn't happen when you have unions. It's much more bureaucratic. It's much slower. Now, I also think people are better off having direct connections with their managers. You think about work differently. You have relationships that are different. We get to hear from a lot of people as opposed to it all being filtered through one voice. If you want to keep the construct that we've had for this long, you have to have competitive and compelling benefits, though, for employees. And it's why we championed the $15 minimum wage a few years ago, and we're up over $18 now. It's why we have full insurance, why 401k, 20 weeks of paid leave, and our career choice program, where in our fulfillment center, for our employees who want to get a college education, we'll pay for their full tuition. So those things really matter. The one thing, regardless of how it all evolves, is we just won't compromise on the customer experience. That, for us, is paramount. And
what did you think when you heard President Biden effectively say, and this is regard to the unions around Amazon, here we come?
Well, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. And, we have a lot of things that we, I think, have supported the administration on and agree with.
Let's talk about the people of it, though, and this labor issue, because it's something that a challenge you've been confronting. A lot of other companies in America have been dealing with the labor movement. It's happening at your firm as well. Last month, workers at a warehouse in Albany voted no on a union. Here in Staten Island, they voted yes, and there's a bit of a battle going on there. But what do you see as the state of this dynamic right now?
Well, in the U.S., there's been only one of our facilities that has voted for a union. It's the Staten Island one you mentioned. There are a lot of irregularities in that vote, which is why there are objections, and it's working its way through the legal process. The last two, a sortation center in Staten Island and the Albany facility you mentioned, have voted against the union. And this is also interesting. It's one of many topics in this country that are very hard to discuss and debate. In fact, you probably saw that the NLRB is suing Amazon over comments I made in our last interview in April.
Yes.
Where, to be careful about what I said, I guess, but where I stated that we didn't favor unions because they were more bureaucratic and limited agility, which I thought was fairly non-controversial and straightforward, but I guess you're not allowed to say that, or some people think you're not allowed to say that. But the truth is that employees get to choose. They always have had the choice. And it's not up to us, it's up to them. And what we tell our employees in our fulfillment centers is that we think they're better off without a union for a few reasons. One is we try to hire people who we empower if they find ways that they can make the experience better for customers or their fellow teammates. They can just go fix it. You know, they don't have to go through a union. It's not bureaucratic, it's not slow, it's not a whole process. They can just go fix that. And we think that that's pretty empowering and a great way to work. And I think it's nice to be able to have a direct relationship with your manager. We like to hear from all our employees as opposed to having it filtered through one or two voices. And I also think when you have unions, you often end up with this us versus them mentality that's not as productive when you're trying to invent and trying to accomplish what we are on the scale we are. And so, you know, I think if you want to operate in the same structure we have without unions, you have to have compelling benefits. And
first vote to unionize at an Amazon warehouse. I know you've been spending a lot of time at warehouses. When you look at someone like Chris Smalls, who I think some people look at as this modern day hero who got fired, pulled off this union vote, what's your message to someone like him? Your message to the folks who think maybe we should join a union?
Well, I think that, you know, the first thing to be clear about is that employees get to make that choice, whether they want to have a union or not. They always have had that choice, and it continues to be their choice. And, you know, we happen to think they're better off without a union for a number of reasons, including the fact that, you know, it's much harder when you have a union to have a direct relationship with your manager and to get things done quickly. So if you see something on the line that you think could be better for your team or you or your customers, you can't just go to your manager and say, let's change this. You know, there's a whole process in bureaucracy that you have to go through to be able to do that. You know, and we get, you know, when there's a union, we're going to get the feedback filtered by what the union decides is worth bringing up. And we'd much rather hear from every employee whatever is on their mind. And so, you know, I think if you want to continue to have the structure that we've had for all this time, you have to have really competitive benefits. And then I think if you look at Amazon's, they're very unusual in this space. We champion the $15 minimum wage several years
ago. So, Phil, knowing what the comments were, I think it was pretty innocuous, at least in what he said seemed to be fairly factual, right? He's talking about empowerment of workers without a union and the bureaucracy as if they become unionized. What's wrong with that?
Inefficiency. Nothing's wrong with that. So, like, let's just be crystal clear. And by the way, everyone just listened to it, but Andy Jassy didn't just, like, hop on television and go, hey, here's some stuff I think about unions. Those statements had been carefully crafted. He said the same basic thing every time. Employees have a right to this decision. But, you know, we don't think unions are in their best interest. They're less efficient. You're less empowered. It's bureaucratic. It takes a long time. Those are all classic statements that employers have been able to make for a long time. They're not considered threats. They're not considered anywhere outside the bounds. And those statements were crafted to be kind of well within the boundary lines of what an employer can say. And then I would add on top of that, this isn't like the CEO talking to somebody working at a fulfillment center, right? This is a CEO being interviewed on a financial news show that probably no Amazon employee is watching and is, you know, this is a very different kind of a setting than if, for example, he was up in front of a room of employees that were getting ready to vote in a union election. You know, context, I think, also matters here. And when you think about the First Amendment rights of an employer and the Section 8C rights of an employer, I think you have to put all of that together as well, right? This is a TV interview. He's asked about a whole series of different topics about his company. One of them is this union topic. And he makes a very basic sort of milquetoast statement about some of the negatives about unions.
And it's viewed as a threat. And I was kind of curious as I was watching them. I wonder how many Amazon employees tune into CNBC Squawk Box every morning. And probably not that many.
Yeah. How many people, period, tune into Squawk Box? I mean, right. It's a pretty like narrow audience. They're mostly, trading. I think that should be part of the context as well. You know, the judges in these cases like to talk about context, and they really try to pick apart just sort of every little word. But I think part of the context here is this is not a speech in the middle of a campaign. Even if it was, by the way, I think it's completely in bounds, but it's very different than a campaign setting.
Well, and the interesting thing is he wasn't necessarily saying something that was not factual.
Right.
And I think the ALJ, said, well, he didn't provide any other, context to it. But the fact is, when you're unionized, you don't go directly to your manager without permission from the union. And it kind of goes back to what Jennifer Abruzzo is trying to do is overturn TriCast, the decision from, I think it was 1995 or 85.
Yeah, but even under TriCast, right? The whole point of TriCast is that Section 9A, that she wants TriCast overturned, but TriCast says under Section 9A, the relationship changes. It's
right
built right into the law. The relationship changes. Now, what Abruzzo is asking the board ultimately, so the ALJ, just to be clear, in this case, the ALJ reviews all these statements that Jassy made and says in the first part of the opinion, these statements are in general protected by TriCast. So I'm not overturning TriCast. I don't have the right to overturn TriCast. I can't ignore the board, although interestingly enough, they later ignore the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. But I can't ignore the board. The board has ruled in TriCast that these statements are protected speech, and that's the way that the judge rules. Now, under 9A, an employee does have a right. So Abruzzo's point is that, look, if you say that the relationship changes and that the employee loses their right to deal directly with the employer, that's illegal because 9A says they can still present individual grievances to their supervisor. But even 9A says the union has a right to be there at that meeting. So you don't get to go to Jassy's point about efficiency. The meeting that you used to be able to have where you would just go to your boss and go, hey, I'd like to present my grievance. Now it's like, okay, well, wait, we have to go call the steward. Because the steward has a right, even if you don't want them there, it doesn't matter. The steward under 9A has a right to be in that meeting.
Yeah,
right? So they don't have to go to it. They could say, well, you can do it by yourself. But like you, from an efficiency standpoint, it's absolute fact. You have to go to the steward and give them a right to be in that meeting. Otherwise, it's an unfair labor practice.
So let me pause you there. I'm going to read something that's directly from the National Labor Relations Board's Basic Guide to the National Labor Relations Act. It's right on page 13. And what you're talking about with Section 9A, so when I'm dealing with employees, I've been explaining this literally ad infinitum because I've got experience as a union rep having dealt with this. But what it says is once a collective bargaining representative has been designated or selected by its employees, it is illegal for an employer to bargain with individual employees, with a group of employees, or with another employee representative. Section 9A, which is what you're talking about, mm-hmm. provides that an employee or a group of employees shall have the right at any time to present grievances to their employer and to have such grievances adjusted without the intervention of the collective bargaining representative, provided the adjustment is not inconsistent with the terms of any collective bargaining agreement then in effect. And this is your point, the bargaining representative has been given the opportunity to be present at such adjustment. That sounds like bureaucracy to me.
It's bureaucracy. It's not efficient. It's exactly what Jassy said. It is built into the law. It is an absolute ironclad fact of life that that happens. If a union is selected as a representative, that all occurs. That's bureaucratic. That's not efficient.
Yeah. And so the only way that an employee group or an employee individual, for that matter, can go directly to their manager is either A, with the permission of the bargaining representative, or if something's been negotiated into the contract, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like back in the 80s when I was with CWA, I mean, we were doing all the quality groups and QWL teams and all that kind of crap, but that had to be negotiated. And I, as a union rep, got to sit in each meeting, which got me off the job.
Well, and to the point about empowerment, right? So Jassy says right now, we hire people that are empowered and that they want to be empowered. And that if they see a new way to do something or a better way to do it, they can go right into a room, suggest it, and we can do it. And that's empowerment. Now, reasonable people might disagree about whether that's better power than whether a union has, but like that's empowerment. That's how he's defining empowerment. And then what you just described takes that power away, right? Either the labor agreement has the power, the union rep, it is illegal, like you just said, it is illegal for the company to negotiate wages, hours, conditions of employment directly with an individual or a group of employees or a different bargaining representative than the one selected. That takes power away. That power that you have right now to go directly to your boss and to make an adjustment or to change something, that goes away because it goes into this bureaucratic process, this less efficient process. Again, an ironclad fact of life under the National Labor Relations Act, which is why that this speech from Jassy must be protected.
It should be, at least, whether it is when it gets to the board.
Eventually. That my point is it will eventually be protected. There is no way that this decision can stand. And can I make a couple comments about the opinion itself?
Absolutely.
So part one, the ALJ is like, my hands are tied, TriCast, employer is allowed to say that the relationship changes. Okay. Part two, which is where the administrative law judge finds that the unfair labor practices have occurred, gotta be just the worst reasoned ALJ decision I think I've ever read. All right. So ALJ, and I'll pull it up here. So the administrative law judge says, you know, these statements, these are the ones you're just talking about. They go way, way beyond the holding in TriCast. There are two decisions that the ALJ points to. All right. So it says, yeah, for example, while 9A contemplates a change to the employer-employee relationship, it does not contemplate whether that change would make employees more empowered or less empowered. It doesn't contemplate that being represented by a union would make it easier or harder to get things done in the workplace. Yet that's what Jassy predicted. By exceeding the types of comments allowed in TriCast, they amounted to unprotected threats. Cites this case, Hendrickson USA LLC, enforcement denied by the Sixth Circuit in 2019, the case that this lawyer, this administrative law judge, cites in defense of the point that he's trying to make was reversed by the Sixth Circuit, which found a statement bargaining from scratch is lawful. So they reversed the board around, bargaining from scratch is kind of like it's a term that you're not really supposed to use. In that particular case, the Sixth Circuit said, look, given the context, we don't even find that threatening. So much, much less egregious language is used by Jassy. The same opinion that the administrative law judge uses to support the claim that these statements are unlawful, the Sixth Circuit clearly would find in bounds. I can't believe that they're citing this case as the authority for finding an unfair labor practice in this case. Not only that, it really illustrates one of the big problems that the National Labor Relations Board and just this entire agency all the way down through the ALJs have, is they just don't pay attention to what a court of appeals says. You know, the NLRB has this whole non-acquiescence doctrine, which drives the courts of appeals crazy, because they're kind of like, yeah, that's your opinion, But until the Supreme Court says something, we're not going to follow it. That's what this ALJ did. They're like, I'm going to cite the board case, even though it was reversed by the Sixth Circuit. I'm still going to cite that case. It's unbelievable. And then the second case that they use, there's only the two cases they use as defense of this finding, this initial finding of the unfair labor practice, is a Starbucks case, in which the finding in that case was, we will cut your pay, we'll cut your benefits, we'll cut your hours, we will withdraw assistance from your supervisor. So like the factual settings are so distinct that it's crazy that they use these two cases as like the defense for this very inbound statement is a threat. I can't believe that that's the reasoning.
Well, and the whole empowerment, you know, and talking about empowerment, that's subjective itself. Like, what is empowerment? You know, you and I probably think of empowerment one way. In the union context, it may be something entirely different.
Mm-hmm. Unions clearly feel like they're empowering employees, which that's like their opinion and they're totally entitled to it. And they can certainly make that argument. Right. But it's not like the employer's counter argument that that's not what we think is empowering, and the employee ultimately gets to decide, right? The first thing Jassy says every single one of these interviews is ultimately this is the employee's choice. They get to decide.
Right.
We have a point of view about this. The union has a point of view about it. But that's the way that this is supposed to work.
And I think in at least two, if not all three of the cases, he begins his comments with, I think, or we think, which mm-hmm. goes to the whole, you're allowed to express opinions.
Yeah.
Right. And he's not threatening taking away wages, benefits, other terms and conditions of employment. It's the communications. And that, in fact, does change.
Right. And look, the Act has this Section 8C that is super clear. And then the Supreme Court says 8C is just basically enforcing the First Amendment. But he has a First Amendment right to speech around his opinion about the subject. As an American citizen, and the fact that he's CEO of a big company does not change that. The Act says there will be no unfair labor practice found just because you're stating your opinion about unions, and that can include predictions that bad things will happen. As long as those predictions aren't, I, as the CEO, am going to do bad things if you guys unionize, which is clearly not what he said. You know, you're allowed to make predictions about, you know, negative consequences happen sometimes when unions come in. Some of those negative consequences he lays out here, right? It's not efficient. You may not even get a contract. You know, if you do get a contract, that contract may not be what you want. Could be worse than what you have now. Might be better, might be the same, might be worse. You know, there's a lot of potential negative consequences of a union. And as long as you're not saying like, I'm going to make bad things happen, or this company will make bad things happen if you unionize, like that's protected speech.
Right. Well, I haven't seen any recent filings. I'm assuming they're appealing this, filing a request for review to the NLRB in Washington.
I haven't seen it, but yes, I mean, of course that's happening.
And I'm unclear based on what I've seen out of the NLRB, if they're going to be in agreement with Abruzzo on this.
Well,
like, to your point, they're using that Sixth Circuit case. Like, surely somebody's going to read that was overturned in the Sixth Circuit.
I would, you know, you would think that whoever, you know, was either researching or writing this opinion might have, well, I mean, they obviously knew it because it says it was enforcement denied. So you had to have at least, like, hopefully you read the opinion, but at least you knew that the court denied enforcement on that. I mean, I don't know. It's super poorly, you know, defended. But look, the board above, they are going to uphold this. I would guess like the board is going to uphold this because that's sort of, you know, all these other like close free speech cases that, you know, that are finding against the employer. This is their vehicle to overturn TriCast if the general counsel convinces them to do that. So like that This could be, they've turned it down so far, the chances that they've had. So this would be another opportunity to overrule TriCast if they wanted to. But either way, unless they just reverse the ALJ, this is getting appealed. And I can't imagine a court of appeals looking at this and going along with this reasoning. It's terrible.
Yeah, but in the meantime, for the listeners who may be going through a campaign, and I've, over the last couple of years since I saw Brusseau's memo, I want to say it was a couple of years ago, where she talked about TriCast, like I've been going through it with employees when I'm meeting with them, all the way down to, the exceptions there.
Yeah, we do too.
Yeah.
You anticipate the case that's going to happen, not,
right.
Don't just hang your hat on this is protected speech, but like, okay, I know they're going to make this argument. So explain 9A. Like 9A is not like a big billboard for efficiency or speedy resolution of problems. Like explaining 9A, don't throw me into that briar patch, right? It's like that, like, okay, we'll explain 9A. That does not really prove unions are some like great thing for employees.
Well, the other thing that it's got a conflict with when it talks about the bargaining representative being able to be present, you look at a union like the Teamsters and several others out there that have within their constitution that whole section where the employee or the member subjugates him or her rights, his or her rights over to the union for all aspects of their employment. Mm-hmm. Which may allow them to not file grievances as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Right?
So, you compile that onto, you've got to go through the union. If you're a union member and you bypass the union, you can actually be put on trial for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, where do we stand with that with the NLRB?
Yeah, and how does that apply? Like, how is that empowering, right?
One would think that the NLRB might find some of those union constitutions unlawful because it's restricting employee rights, but I haven't seen a case come up on that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they would find a way to not rule that way, but
right.
Yeah, I mean, so you bring up a really good point. Like this is why prior restraints on speech are unlawful. This whole behavior of the agency, of the general counsel in particular, and I always make a point, like, look, Jennifer Abruzzo is really smart and is really, very activist and has like a path, is like no question, got to be without a doubt. And I've heard like other former general counsels of the NLRB say this, but I think it's, you've got to bow down to the fact that I don't think anyone's been like more effective in that role probably ever. But that said, like this tortured, attempt to turn this law into, if you don't roll over and just invite the union in, like you're not doing it correctly. It's wrong. That's not what the statute says. It's not the way that these campaigns are supposed to be done. It's not even furthering good labor relations because it's basically forcing a union on people that don't really understand how it works. And then once they get into it and understand how it works, like they have buyer's remorse because it's like, well, I thought I was going to get all this stuff and it was going to happen fast. And like, why, like what's happening? And why can't I settle this thing directly? Why do I have to have a steward in here if I don't want him in here? All of these things, if you don't educate people about that, like they all of a sudden have a union in place and are like, I didn't want this.
Well, it builds resentment.
Right. It's just, and then all these threats of all the litigation that's going to happen, is basically putting employers in the place where I don't really feel comfortable meeting with my employees. I don't feel comfortable educating them about how this all works because I'm worried that I'm going to be branded a union buster and I'm going to have like all of these unfair labor practices filed. And now under CEMEX, I'm going to have I'm going to be forced to bargain with the union, even if my employees don't vote for it. Like all of this stuff, the entire weight of the federal government is basically you know, trying to keep the employer just totally on the sidelines and gagged during these campaigns. And that's not the way the law is written. It's not the way it's supposed to work. It's not good for labor relations. It's unfortunate.
Well, you and I have been around long enough to remember the prior iteration of the PRO Act, which was EFCA, and that was, you know, card check. So I can trick employees into signing cards, unionize them without them voting on it, and then the government's going to lock the company and the union into a contract for 2 years.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really, I mean, if you go back a century ago and what unions fought for was not to have the government dictating labor relations.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously unions have become wards of the state in that regard.
Yeah.
And, you know, that from a worker standpoint, as you're mentioning, it just, you know, if I'm a worker, and what is the union doing for me if the government's doing it anyway? They're dictating my wages and benefits. Mm-hmm. Basically, the union's just taking my money. And why do I need a union?
Mm-hmm.
California, yeah, I mean, the fast food workers, you know, why are they going to unionize if the government's giving them $20 an hour?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point, right? Like and going back to the whole empowerment, like it's not empowering.
Right.
It's taking your individual power away. Now it's creating this group, but the group is controlled by a small number of people that are not your coworkers, and it's not you. And like that's who has the power. So like power does change. It just goes to them, right? And the employer continues to have power. There's just this bureaucratic process that you have to go through in order to exercise that power that they currently don't have to do. And look, I mean, you know, to be fair, like, you know, that's one of the things the unions have to sell, right? Is that right now the employer can make changes and can do things and they can do them fast. And so, you know, the flip side to the efficiency argument is, well, you can change things whenever you want. And like, I don't like that. Okay. Well that's a legitimate point to debate about which of those two things is better. And from employees' standpoint, an employer changing things rapidly and everything's always in flux, like that's really frustrating. And a union can, to the extent that those are like bargainable subjects and are not like covered by a management rights clause, like they can slow that stuff down. So that's Jassy's, you know, Jassy's side of that is like, that's inefficient.
Right.
And, but the union can go like, we can slow down the pace of change. So like there, you know, but neither one of those two statements should be illegal.
That's correct. And unfortunately, the board's so biased that they don't see the two sides of the coin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, I want to give them credit. Like, this is a pretty poorly reasoned opinion. And I think it would be, let's see, you know, Kaplan will be a, you know, if they rule the way that this ALJ ruled, Kaplan will be a dissent. But depending on what the panel is, I mean, I those are smart lawyers on the Democratic side, and they can read this opinion and see what I see and read the tea leaves as sort of what circuit courts of appeal might do with a case like this. Like, this does not seem like the right vehicle either for overturning TriCast. Like, the facts are terrible on this for overturning TriCast. And I just feel like this was a result, you know, that had been decided. And then they were looking for, like, grasping for whatever straws they could to support that result. But this is not a well done opinion. And we'll see what happens with it.
To your point earlier, I mean, it would make more sense to take a case like this up where a CEO was literally standing in front of a group of employees and said something maybe not as benign, maybe in the vein that Jassy said it, but a little bit further to be able to overturn TriCast. This was stated to a bunch of, you know, A, to television cameras, B, to reporters, mm-hmm. I think, in one of the cases, mm-hmm. at a book review summit. So right. It's like, how many employees actually even saw it until the union brought it up?
And I mean, yeah, I could see the argument, like, look, it's a, you know, it's a national television program, and right. it's the New York Times, you know, it's the paper of record, right? So like, so there's, you know, so anybody could see it, and probably some, I'm sure Amazon employees somewhere saw it, right? So it's not like, I'm not really hanging my hat on that, but it's just the context is very different than I'm talking to the CEO of the company, like right before I vote, is a very right. different type of interaction. Now, like I said before, even if those were the facts, which they're not, but even if they were, I still think this is all totally in bounds. You know, like, I mean, literally, I mean, I'm just like, I'm reading the ALJ opinion, but based on the foregoing, Jassy's comments threatened employees because he said if they selected a union, A, they would become less empowered, and B, would find it harder to get things done quickly. Like, those are the two threats. Like, that is just so ridiculous. Yeah, so anyway, we'll see what the board does with it. It would not surprise me if the board rubber stamps this over a, like, very vociferous dissent from Kaplan, and then, like, we'll see what the courts of appeal do with it. But there's no circuit court's going to go along with this. And then, I mean, gosh, if it gets in front of the Supreme Court, we've talked about this before, but I think this is the biggest problem that this board and general counsel have, is this sort of be careful what you wish for, right? Because they, you know, like, they may overturn TriCast on this. Like, if this opinion goes up in front of a court of appeals or the Supreme Court, where, like, they've overturned TriCast on this set of facts, that's going to create law that is going to be very, very different than where Abruzzo wants it to be. And, like, that's the real challenge that they have right now, is they're really, I mean, they're pushing the envelope, like, just beyond recognition, and the courts of appeals are not going to go along with it.
Well, what I hear you saying is be careful what you wish for. By the time it goes to the courts of appeal or Supreme Court, they could totally eviscerate the logic that she's trying mm-hmm. to push.
Yeah, they're just going to go TriCast. You know what? We think TriCast is a great idea, and that's the law of the land for the rest of time. And statements like these that Jassy made are well within the protected speech rights of an employer. And, like, they, yeah, if the Supreme Court gets a chance to kind of do that, there's not a whole lot more you're going to be able to do down below, right? Like, they'll set the new boundary lines. So I think that's the risk. That CEMEX is the same thing, right? Like, they, you know, the Supreme Court could come down as secret ballot elections are the gold standard, and we meant what we said in Gissel. And, you know, like, that opinion, if it gets that far, is very likely not only going to sort of, like, unwind what they did in CEMEX, but they're putting the court into a position to go, like, okay, we really meant it. The employer has to have committed really egregious unfair labor practices before we're going to let an election not decide these things, and really will unwind a bunch of the sort of the theory that's behind, you know, what the general counsel is trying to do here.
So, talking about CEMEX for a minute, we're looking at, if that goes to the Supreme Court, you're probably looking at another year or two, guessing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then this one would be potentially another 3 to 4 years down the road.
Probably. I mean, the board has to deal with it. Yeah. The board probably doesn't deal with this before the election. So what happens then? There's just a lot of, like, water under the bridge. So, yeah, you're probably talking 3 to 4 years on this. Like you said, CEMEX, I mean, you know, that's, I think, in front of the Ninth Circuit, and that hasn't, you know, they haven't had oral argument on that. I mean, you know, that one is months away. So, yeah, it'll be a while.
And
in the meantime, of course, employers are kind of stuck with, well, what's the law, right?
Right. I was going to come to that in a second. So if I recall the justices, there's probably two of them that are up there in age. So 3 to 4 years down the road, we may have a different Supreme Court. Of course, everything's political, so it depends on, you know, who mm-hmm. wins the White House, et cetera. To your point a second ago, so we are now operating under a new standard based on Jassy's comments, and I mentioned this, and you guys are doing it as well. So since Abruzzo came out with her memo a couple years ago with TriCast, you know, most smart people out there have adjusted the way in which they explain mm-hmm. Section 9A, et cetera.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's some that might not, but I assume your advice is the same as mine. Parse your statements.
Yeah. I mean, look,
explain it all.
Yeah. And it's not like we tell all of our team, you know, be very careful about how you describe stuff and keep it based on the law. Just explain the law, like the law right. by itself. You just were reading out of the basic guide to the act, but, you know, read what does the law say? What do the cases say? What does so stick to that. You don't really need to get into, you know, predictions, and you don't need to get into like that sort of stuff. Just explain how it actually works. Right. And that's based on the law, and it sort of speaks for itself. But like I said earlier, this whole explain 9A, that does not make it, I mean, that's not a great sales pitch for unions.
Right.
It's like, I understand the point that the general counsel is making is that, well, employers like to, you know, they're it's basically just trying to like trip up employers, right? Well, employers like to say the direct relationship is going to change. And so I want to make it like harder for them to say that. And so I'm going to make them explain this other thing, but explaining the other thing does not make it sound good to unionize.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell the story once in a while that when I was a union rep, I was chief steward at the time. So I was a union rep in a right to work state. So that meant we had members and non-members.
Mm-hmm.
The non-members are still covered by the union. And that means that even under 9A, that non-members can't go meet with management over right. their own grievance without the union being present. And I had a supervisor that met with a non-member. Now, he correctly answered her, did not give her something that she didn't, you know, she wasn't entitled to under the contract. She wanted extra time off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after the meeting, she walked out of his office. I said, what did so-and-so want? And he explained it and I said, okay, cool. You didn't give her something she wasn't entitled to. However, if you meet with her again like that, mm-hmm. without me being present, I'm going to file a ULP.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's Section 9A. I had mm-hmm. the right to be there.
Right. And that's like a lot of employees in that setting, right? It's a right to work state. I'm not a member.
Right.
They may not want you there. Right.
Exactly.
Like they're not paying you, you know, they're not paying you money for a reason. They want to represent themselves probably, but like, they don't have that right. That went away. And yep. that's 9A. And so that's the part that I think you know, when you're explaining 9A, you explain that part too, whether you mm-hmm. want your rep there or not. And you may want to have a private conversation, you know, with your supervisor about something that's personal, but is you're trying to adjust some sort of a grievance, the union still has a right to be there, even if you don't want them there. And if you don't, like you just, your example is exactly right. If the supervisor meets with that employee and the employee says like, I want it to be private, and I just want to talk to you about this problem that I have, and you don't tell the union and give them the opportunity to be there, they can file in for labor practice. You for sure committed one. That's the way that this works, which goes back to Jassy's point. Not efficient, not empowering.
Right. Yep. So what else should we talk about?
Big election coming up here. When do they open the ballots on that? I'm talking about the...
The one in Alabama?
Mercedes-Benz.
I thought it was Friday evening, although somebody told me earlier it might be sometime during the day, around lunchtime.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but so that'll be interesting. That's That's kind of the UAW's next foray. I thought it's interesting they filed like 6 unfair labor practice charges yesterday. To me, that sort of indicates they may be seeing the writing on the wall, but we'll see. I've thought that thing was going to be close, and you know, who knows? But they're already setting up their CEMEX case.
That would be interesting to see CEMEX impose a union on thousands of workers if mm-hmm. they voted against it.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. But that's going to be, so that's going to be a big, that'll be a big case. Really, either way it goes, obviously, if, you know, if they vote the union in, then that's sort of, you know, Sean Fain will, you know, that victory tour will be, you know, fun to watch. And then if they lose, it's just going to be, you know, Mercedes is this terrible employer right. and did all these bad things and it's not our fault. And so anyway, they're, that's a big one.
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, I was mentioning this earlier on the phone with somebody. I believe Alabama, for all this talk about Southern states being non-union and all that, Alabama's mm-hmm. union density, I believe, is around 10 or 11% last
year. They're surprisingly, I mean, there's a lot. So like shipyards and a lot of heavy manufacturing that's unionized in Alabama. So it's definitely a lot more, a lot more unionized than you would think. I do think in general, though, you know, there's still part of that. Just this, you know, Southerners don't, you know, I don't think anybody really likes being told, you know, what to do. But there is kind of an independent streak in the South that I don't think is as compatible with organized labor as it is in other parts of the country. But
well, the interesting thing with the UAW. And I did a post on this a couple of weeks ago. They have almost as many people on college campuses as they do in right. the auto industry. And the amount of UAW activists who are also out there protesting for Gaza and mm-hmm. you know, pro-Palestinian, it's very interesting juxtaposition on what the Southern attitude is like.
Oh, for sure. Just the general politics of unions and who they contribute to and all that is, you know, and that's not just in the South. Union members just in general have right. Parted ways with the general view, sort of like union leadership goes one way and a lot of their members, like significant percentages, 60-ish percent of their members are, you know, Trump voters, while the leadership is definitely not. And like you're giving your money, whatever political viewpoint you are, like you just need to understand, if you're giving money to a labor union, that money is by and large going to be used to promote Democratic candidates across the country, many right. of whom are in places that you don't live. So like that's where your money goes, that's where your influence goes. And you know, a lot of people don't really understand that. And you know, that's another thing that probably should come up in most campaigns, that you know, employers are, you know, like, you know, are kind of sometimes afraid to get into that, but like it's a fact.
I remember a campaign some years ago at an ammunition maker, actually it was a gun maker, and I remember this young pro-union employee saying, dues don't go towards politics. Mm-hmm. And I pulled it up real quick and it was, you know, $10,000 to Nancy Pelosi, NRA rating was F, mm-hmm. you know, just went down the list. I was like, yeah, really?
Yeah.
But anyway.
The one other big one and then we can run, but what are you hearing about the Starbucks negotiations?
Nothing other than what's been reported.
Yeah, so me too, which I think is interesting. There's not a lot right. being reported, which I think is very notable. Like this was such a sort of high profile, lots and lots and lots of you know videotaping the bargaining sessions and blah, 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 right? Like there was a lot of that. And it's been interesting to see kind of like these negotiations appear, now it's early, but like appear to be kind of under control and looking a lot more like an adult, you know, bargaining situation, which.
Well, you did a post on the chaos of having, I don't remember the number, if it's 150 baristas watching it in, you know, right. Sitting around. It's like, huh, this will be interesting.
Where are all those tweets or whatever you call them now? But you know what I mean? Like it's pretty interesting.
So the adults in the room had to take over.
I would not have wanted to be like on the union side of that. I would not have wanted to be in charge of like trying to keep all that under control. But I mean, look, credit where it's due, and it's a little early, but that like that's pretty surprising and pretty impressive.
Yeah, harnessing the cats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in fairness, I haven't gone looking on social media for any of the Starbucks workers who've been.
That stuff finds us, like right. I mean, I think if it got really crazy, I think we would see it. So, it's early, and I mean, Starbucks probably hasn't really started saying no to stuff yet, and so things could definitely go different, but even at this early stage, I still would have thought there'd be more kind of gnashing of teeth than there is. So I think it's interesting. And I think it might be, I don't know, like who gets the credit for that? But I mean, you've been on, you've been in contract negotiations. I have, and you've been on both sides, like keeping a bargaining committee quiet and just sort of keeping them together, and that could be, just like 5 or 6 people on a bargaining committee, 150 plus like 400 on Zoom or whatever it is. That's impressive.
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't been on TikTok, so I loathe to go on there, but that's probably, if there's anything out there, it's like got to be on TikTok.
Yeah. Well, hey, sir? This is fun. Thanks for inviting me. And it's cool to do, to do this as sort of like a joint episode. So we'll drop this to,
we need to do it again.
Viewers. And
as always, I enjoy having you on the podcast. I like hearing your perspective. It's the Mozart and Metallica reference.
Mozart?
I think I used Mozart with you because you used to wear a bow tie.
Yeah. I like Mozart, but I also like Metallica, so I can go either way. But I feel the same way about you. It's always great to hear your point of view on this stuff. So thanks for doing it.
Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon.
All right, see you.